Well, it's a great pleasure for me to be here and to have Gordon offer that generous introduction. Since since my talk is going to be followed by a little bit of music, I want to start by saying that I have my own personal confession to make about my relationship to Mozart, not of a personal kind, but a professional one. We have in the archives at Stanford a tape, runs 58 minutes, of an event that took place 4 years ago, when several of my colleagues from the law school and I joined with our local resident string quartet, the St. Lawrence Quartet, and a young guy named Rob Capello, who's a music educator from Yale. And we produced we produced a long session called Originalism, Music, and the Constitution. And it pivoted around a discussion of my book that Gordon mentioned, my earlier book, Original Meanings, and the fact that Mozart wrote Eine kleine Nacht music in the summer of 1987. He finishes it in mid-August 1787. He finishes it in mid-August 1787, and of course the convention is still meeting. Eine kleine Nacht music is known more formally as the, I have to get this right now, Serenade number 13 in G major. And of course the number 13 looms very large in American historiography, demonstrating Mozart's interest in the future foundations of the American Union. The problem with this tape is we've never been able to get anybody to run it. So it lies there inert. And it's my great hope being here tonight that my book will not quite suffer the same fate as the tape. So that's a bit of an informal introduction. I'm also grateful, I should say at the very outset, to Leslie Berlowitz, who I saw out in the Bay Area about a month or so ago when we talked about this, for the opportunity and the challenge to be a part of this evening's celebration. The major part of this evening is obviously the celebration of the Academy's 230th anniversary, and my pitching my book, if I can use that term, is really only the minor part of it. And I'm a little reluctant to stand up here on so grave an occasion and to say that I'm actually engaged in a book pitch, which doesn't sound quite like the right expression to use. But what I would like to do this afternoon is just to say a little bit about what I'm attempting to do in my book, and then in what I hope will be a somewhat, I don't want to say backdoor, but a somewhat indirect, yet I hope fertile way, try to draw some connections between some of the things I talk about in the book and the occasion of the Academy's founding. And I'll bring John Adams and also George Mason from Virginia into this story and try to think about a way to pitch the history of the Academy with some larger issues in early American history. You know, historians for the past decade have been puzzled, taken aback by, and also in some occasions attempting to take advantage of the phenomenon that we call founder chic, which is kind of the shorthand term that many scholars have used to describe the remarkable popularity over the last 10 or 15 years of books about the founding era. Exactly why this is the case, exactly why some books have done so well and why these books have challenged some of us to ask, can we join in this market and both contribute to it and perhaps take advantage of it, poses, I think, something of a puzzle. It's not immediately clear at the first glance, exactly why the revolution should be so popular. It is, after all, a very distant world that people like Gordon and I and our mutual professor, Bernard Balin, and so many other scholars have tried to reconstruct. It's a very distant world. There are no good movies about the founding period as opposed to the Civil War, and I doubt there ever will be. So it's a little hard to say exactly what is the appeal of the founding. Writing this book, I happen to think in part that, and I've felt this for a long time, that perhaps the founding does appeal to Americans because in a certain sense, its ending is rather happier than the Civil War. The Civil War, as we know from a recent episode in Virginia, remains an object of some controversy, indeed of division, in the body politic. The revolution is a story of founding. Whatever its shortcomings on some fronts, it leaves an impressive record of achievement. So that perhaps that's one reason. The second reason might be, and this is something I got very aware of writing the book, is that Americans have made the documentary evidence of the founding one of the great achievements of modern, not just historical scholarship, but of modern editing. When you set out to work on this history, in a serious way, you can't help but be impressed by the enormous volume of materials that have been produced for founders, both major and minor. The enormous documentary record, which is now readily accessible, certainly in university libraries, increasingly online, increasingly both in printed forms and in manuscript form, you know, scores and scores and scores of volumes, so that you can approach this subject matter. You can approach not just the great issues of revolutionary politics, but also the lives and the concerns and the shifting careers and values and doubts and anxieties and ambitions of the founders with this immense documentary record. I don't think there's any other nation in the history of the world which has, in a kind of almost inadvertent way, done so much to make the record of its founding available to later generations. And so you can't help but write a book. When you work on the subject, you can't help but be impressed by the enormous labor that's made knowledge of the period. Again, not just the great documents, but you know, thousands of personal letters discussing all kinds of topics available. So when I set out to write Revolutionaries, and I'll just say something very briefly about what the book does. The basic object of the book was to write a narrative history of the revolution, to do so in a way that would be fairly, couldn't be comprehensive because the subject is too vast, but it could be broad. And so I set myself the task of covering essentially the period from 1773 down to 1792, and that was the period from the Boston Tea Party, so much in the news recently, down to the split in Washington's cabinet between Jefferson and Hamilton that leads to the formation of political parties. And what I wanted each chapter to do was to bring on stage one or two or three characters, essentially a small set who I could talk about with some intensity biographically, and use that discussion to illustrate some fundamental facet of the revolution. So I start, and I'll just say, since I am a little sheepish about doing a book talk here, so basically the book has three parts, first called The Crisis, the second called The Challenges, the third called Legacies. The first part really begins in and around here, and it argues very specifically that although the revolution has deep causes springing from the fundamental divide between Britain and America, that the events that take place in Massachusetts really were fundamental in 1772, 1773. The crisis that surrounds the Boston Tea Party was a crisis that no one on either side of the Atlantic really anticipated. I rely a lot here in many ways on Professor Balin's biography of Thomas Hutchinson, really I think the greatest work of modern historical biography, certainly for this period, to really try to explain why Hutchinson's somewhat, I don't want to say perverse, but decision to try to force the tea to be landed produced such untoward consequences. So I want to start the story by talking about and then how the British government reacts to the Boston Tea Party, which nobody had really anticipated or foreseen. So I want to start with that crisis, talk then about why the moderates, drawn from other states, were willing to, in effect, take a part with Massachusetts in this struggle, which in some ways is a very surprising decision. Look at people like John Jay or Robert Morris, John Dickinson. Then say something about Washington's key role in making sure the moderates and others stayed on board with his attempt to get the Continental Army up and running. That's the crisis, the first few years of the revolution. Challenges, part two, deals with kind of new issues that came up, one of which I'll talk about in a couple minutes. Primarily, the first is the challenge of constitution making, and that's what I'll come back to. And then the issue of slavery, which I talked about with a very interesting story of Henry and John Laurens, a father, and not household names. I'm sure most of you have never heard of either of them. Henry was the president of the Continental Congress. John, or Jack, his son, was one of Washington's aides, very close friend of Hamilton, who comes up with the visionary idea of offering slaves freedom if they'll enlist and fight on the American side. And it's a kind of very interesting kind of Turgenev father-son story about the relationship between the two of them. Then finally, the story of our diplomats overseas. That's part two. And legacies, well, that's easy. That's Jefferson, Madison, and Hamilton. And as you know, Gordon said, you know, Madison is my hero, or usually I like to say my alter ego. A lot of times I'm at conferences, I notice if people want to say something critical about Madison, they look at me. I think it's actually inadvertent at this point to see if I'm going to be offended or, you know, hurt or whatever. It's okay. You know, I'm happy to talk about him critically. So that's the architecture of the book, and I won't say anything more about it as a book, except to say that's essentially what it's about. I'll be happy to sign copies later for all who want to read them. I think it's a good read. I'm very proud of it. Let me turn now to the subject for this evening and try to draw some connection between the founding events that concern me and the founding of this association. And I think the best way to start that is just to kind of go back over a couple of the few basic facts about the foundations of the Academy. So the basic story runs something like this. John Adams comes back from Paris, where he's been somewhat unhappy, not as unhappy as he would be on his second trip, but comes back from his first tour of diplomatic duty, where he got there too late to be of service, but try to bring some order and system to the American mission. He comes back to Massachusetts in 1779, at this point thinking he's what he wants to do, first and foremost, is to perhaps go back to practice of law and take care of his family. He's very quickly elected to the convention that's been newly assigned and newly elected to write a constitution for Massachusetts. That convention had hundreds of members, and it very quickly elected a committee of 30 to frame a constitution, who very quickly elected a subcommittee of 3, who very quickly turned to John Adams and said, "You do it." And so John went back to the farm, and I think happy to work with Abigail and the kids around him, and began working on the Constitution. But during this period, he also went back into Boston one evening in late August to attend a dinner hosting the Chevalier de la Luzerne, the second French minister to the United States. And while there, he pitched to pitched the Reverend Samuel Cooper, a very well-known Puritan divine, Boston divine, the idea of founding a learned academy on the model of the American Philosophical Society. I hope it's okay to mention that name. In Philadelphia and the other learned societies that he had witnessed or knew about in Paris, and then of course also in England. And very quickly thereafter, Adams learns that he has to go back to France as the American minister to negotiate a peace. So he leaves his draft of the Constitution behind, heads off to France with John Quincy and Charles along with him, and won't be back to the United States until 1788. But the idea flourishes in his absence, and in the spring of 1780, just as the Constitution is being adopted, the Massachusetts General Court passes a suitable act in chartering the academy, which we're observing tonight. And of course, the Massachusetts Constitution also contained a provision, becomes eventually Article 6 in the finished draft of the Constitution, which also lays down, as early constitutions are wont to do, a general principle that perhaps one of the ends of public government should indeed be to foster knowledge and learning among the citizens in general. So that's the basic backstory. Here's the way in which I would, in a sense, try to frame it in terms of some of the issues that interest me and that I try to address more explicitly in the book. So when the Academy was founded, if you ask the question, what would its purposes be? How would it operate? How would it function? What role would it play in a world of learning yet to be created in the American colonies? It would have been very difficult to come up with any one coherent answer. I mean, it was a great idea. In practice, how it would work remained to be determined. It would be a function of any of a number of variables, ranging from the kind of support it received to the kind of real work being done intellectually in American society. So in a sense, it was a kind of leap in the dark in terms of how it would function, what results it would produce. And I think some of the early history of the Academy, would in many ways bear this out. If we think today about what the Academy was designed to do, I think we might say something like, well, it's essentially, in a somewhat neutral, maybe social science sense of the term, it was there to promote the distribution of knowledge. It's a kind of, whether it would sponsor knowledge or be a forum for its exchange, well, that would be hard to say, but it's a way whereby a Republican society could begin to develop institutions to allow its intellectually active members to have some forum, to have some mechanism, to have some vehicle for the exchange of ideas, for the development of collective knowledge through discussion and through debate. And indeed, in the history of the early Enlightenment, I've recently been reading the works of Jonathan Israel, which are a great labor and very productive in many ways. One of the things Israel talks about in his discussions around Enlightenment is, in fact, the role that these societies played in the development of Enlightenment ideas. The Americans are following the wake, and you can see how this fits generally in the intellectual history of the early modern period. So that's a kind of background consideration. Now let's think about a different way in which Americans really were contributing knowledge. I mean, Adams probably thought that the first kind of information Americans should really contribute would be knowledge of their own environment, very much like Thomas Jefferson writing Notes on the State of Virginia, in a sense a biography of the state with attention to both its natural and its cultural properties. So the first thing Americans really had to know and think systematically about was what was the nature of the environment in which they lived and in which they operated. So clearly natural history would have been a major part of this discovery, and that would be a process of discovery and exploration, systematic analysis of the natural phenomena that one found. And that would take some time. There was, however, one other area in which Americans already had made a great deal of progress in terms of asking, how do we go about providing a foundation for the exchange of ideas across a society? And which Europeans, which learned men on both sides of the ocean would immediately say the Americans are creating a serious basis for thinking about innovation and the exchange of information that no other society has yet attained. And that obvious basis was the great enterprise of constitution making, which was first and foremost, I say, is the subject of Gordon's great book of 1969, The Creation of the American Republic, book on which I've been building myself, I think, or trying to add to and extend and refine for a long period. This process, it wasn't just about Philadelphia in 1787, it's a process that begins in the states with independence, and then Massachusetts plays a critical role in this process. That's, of course, John Adams' function in 1779, and my alter ego, whatever, James Madison, comes back, plays a critical role in 1787. And the one area of knowledge exchange in which the Americans were first and foremost the leading experts had to do with the process of constitution making. Now, why do I say this is about exchange? Because, and this is where I think the argument, I hope, will get a little bit more subtle, because the process of exchange here has multiple dimensions. Part of the American story, it's primitively conceived in 1776 and much better understood because of Massachusetts by 1787. Part of the story pivots around the role that the people, however perceived or defined, the role that the collective entity of the people would play in the process of constitution making. And the question of how and why the people come to give their consent in some active sense to a process of constitutional formation is one of the great theoretical breakthroughs, and not just theoretical, one of the great practical breakthroughs that the Americans engineered. And I'll try to say just a couple words about this down the road. But the other process here has to do with the process not of constitutional approval writ large, has to do with the process of constitutional draftsmanship. It has to do with the question of how do you create a constitution? What kind of work is it that will actually produce that kind of document? And again, this is what Gordon set out to do in his dissertation a long time ago, and what others of us have tried to look at as well. And here I think the story becomes more complicated. So I frame my the fourth chapter of my book, a chapter called The First Constitution Makers, primarily with George Mason, who's probably the leading constitutional draftsman of 1776, though John Adams' famous pamphlet, Thoughts on Government, is also a very significant part of this story. And the problem I try to wrestle with is this, that if you look, we know much less in detail about how the state constitutions were framed. People weren't really keeping anything like Madison's notes of debate. There's much less public, there's some interesting public discussion. It's not nearly as sustained or voluminous as the discussions from 1787, 1788. So there's enough material to work with, but not quite enough to build as full a story as ideally one would like to tell. But one thing I think we know pretty well is that in most of the states, I think Pennsylvania would be the one significant exception here, constitution making, in the literal sense of draftsmanship, of how do you create the document, devolves upon a relatively small number of people. In Virginia, it's really George Mason, who's a self-educated man, a deeply learned Republican. Most of what Mason learned, he taught himself after his father died. His father dies, falls off his ferry crossing the Potomac one day, and drowns, but Mason was brought up then by not just his mother, but by a marital uncle who was an interesting character named Mercer, an Irish immigrant, a lawyer who knew much more law than Virginia justices of the peace, who built an immense library that Mason simply worked his way through. In Virginia, it's someone like George Mason. In New York, the work tends to devolve upon people like John Jay, Robert Livingston, Gouverneur Morris, a handful of elitists who do most of the work. In Maryland, there's an interesting story where there's a kind of a populist upsurge representing kind of poorer and, you know, smaller farmers, but in the end, the Constitution winds up being drafted by Charles Carroll of Carrollton and a handful of other Maryland elitists. In Massachusetts, as I said, there's a convention of 400 or so. They appoint a committee of 30, they appoint a subcommittee of 3, and they say, Adams, you do it. And then, of course, the convention gets a chance to revise a bit, but essentially it's John Adams' work and the draftsmanship. So there is this interesting story, you know, and I think a complicated story, that on the one hand, American constitutionalism rests from the beginning on a belief in some form of popular sovereignty, On the other hand, it relies in practice upon the, in the actual sense of the term, on a handful of people who are actually working pretty hard, and they're, consulting, and they have to do some coalition building and the like. But the number of really active constitution makers, I think, in the first pass was quite limited. Even when we get to Philadelphia in 1787, there are 55 delegates who attend the convention, but probably about 95% of the discussion involves maybe a dozen, 15 of them, with a number of others sitting silently. So I think there's an interesting question that's embedded in this story of how does a, how does a Republican society like the American colonies becoming states, how do they go about organizing knowledge, pooling it, which members of it are best qualified to play an active role, what role will the people play in the story? That's essentially the story I tried to tell in chapter 4 of my book. And I'll make one last point here, and then we wrap it up and go on to the music. If we flash forward, but this is a subsequent point, if we flash forward to 1787, 1788, one of the striking things that happens here, and it draws upon the experience of Massachusetts. So let me just tell this one little story and we'll call it a wrap. In Massachusetts is the first state that says a constitution has to be not just proposed by delegates representing the people, it has to be ratified by the people as well. But the Massachusetts Convention can't quite figure out exactly how, what form that ratification should take. So when it sends the Constitution out to the Massachusetts towns, it doesn't tell them what they're supposed to do. It doesn't tell them how they're supposed to ratify. So the towns do a whole variety of things. Some voted up, some voted down. Some say we like Article 1, we're not sure about Article 2. Some say it'd be good with these amendments. There's no finite, there's no one form, there's no simple checkoff box to say, yes, we approve, let's go ahead and implement it. When the convention comes back in a session after the horrible winter of 1780, when there are record snowfalls, it kind of takes these returns and it looks at them and it says, well, it looks like it's ratified, let's put it into effect. I mean, that's the simplest way to describe what happened. And on the whole, they're probably right, but we're not 100% sure about the principle they're working there. Madison looks at this and he comes up with, the very last point, he comes up with a really interesting argument in 1787, 1788, in which he says, for a constitution to be a constitution, it has to rest on popular sovereignty. It has to, and this is one of the themes of the next to last chapter of my book, it has to rest on a strong vote of approval by the people. But when the people act, they can really do only one, they can say only one of two words. They can say yes, or they can say no. They might propose amendments, but they're only proposing. They can't make the their adoption of the Constitution depend upon the adoption of the amendments. They can propose it, they can have lots of reasons and expectations why they would hope the first Congress would take them up, but the process has to be pure and simple. That was an act of foundation that I think really, in both theoretical terms and practical political terms, really was brilliant. As I say, it takes the doctrine of popular sovereignty, it takes the very idea of foundation, it's been so much a part of early modern political thinking, but so abstract. And it gives it a concrete form. And the form is that when the Constitution is adopted, there's nothing equivocal about the final form of its adoption. So it was, I don't want to say it's a pure act of foundation, because a lot of politics went into it, and there are a lot of ways in which we can talk about that story. And this fall, our colleague Pauline Mayer is going to produce a book, which I think is really going to be the first really modern story of what the ratification of the Constitution was like. But in terms of the history of political theory, it was a great act of foundation. In terms of the life of the American intellect, I hope and think I can say the foundation of the American Academy was also part of that story. And that's my contribution to this anniversary. Thank you very much.